I'm Elizabeth Austin, and this is the session on blessings, the first of two sessions. How many of you were in the session first thing this morning with Casey and Lacey? Okay, so about half the room. They talked a little bit about the idea that in these sessions, everyone brings their expertise. And so this is a conversation among experts. And I feel especially strongly that that is true in this session, because I know that there are people in the room who are much more versed in the idea of blessing, maybe the history of blessing. And I come at this subject from the perspective of a poet whose roots are in Catholicism, but no longer are nourished there. So I had 12 years of Catholic school, had a period of my life when I went to Mass 6 days a week. So I know that world well, but that's not the world I live in now. And now poetry is my spiritual practice, both reading it and writing it. And that's where I'm coming from with this session today and tomorrow, and with the packet of poems that you have, which is a selection almost exclusively, although not entirely exclusively, by women poets who would not necessarily designate themselves as religious. Or if they are religious, they come from a wide variety of religious backgrounds. And so my plan for the session is just that we will read some of these poems aloud today together and see where they lead us. And so the format for that is going to be that I'm going to read a poem aloud once, and then I'm going to ask one of you, welcome, to read it aloud a second time. And I know for some people, reading poems maybe that they've never seen before aloud can be a little bit scary, but the reason why I don't just read it again myself is that when you read a poem out loud, you attend to it differently. And so I wouldn't want to rob you of that chance to attend closely to a poem by reading it out loud. So we'll hear it twice, and then after we hear it twice, I'll just invite you to call out any words, phrases, lines that are speaking to you, to just call them out into the room. And then I'll ask a few open-ended questions. And here's something that's super important for you to know. There is no quiz. There is no quiz, and I will not ask you to tell me what the theme or the meaning of the symbolism is in any poem. And I say that because so many of us, our exposure to poetry was fraught with some sort of sense of being judged or some feeling that poetry was a riddle that we were supposed to solve and were failing at solving. So that is not part of this experience of poetry. Poems are first and foremost experiences of language. And so your attention is what these poems ask of you, and you are entirely sufficient, more than sufficient, to the task. Okay? The other thing I would say is that in tomorrow's sessions, we're going to be writing our own blessings. So I really encourage you, as you're hearing these poems, if there are particular words that are feeling juicy or resonant or intriguing for you, that you just jot them down. One of the things that I like to do when I begin writing is to bring some sort of company onto the page with me. I don't know about you, but the blank page can be intimidating. And if I have some form of company, whether it's a few words that I borrowed from another writer or a structure, I feel less lonely at the page, and the page feels less blank to begin. So I just encourage you to jot things down. Maybe you have your holding journal that you were given with you, and that's a great place to do that. Welcome. So one other thing I want to say to start is that I think most of you know Linda Evans, who for several years was the medic here and many other things, and is much beloved by me and by everybody else who knows her. So when I first came to Holden, she turned me on to the work of Jan Richardson, who I did not know previously. So Jan Richardson and Linda Evans are in some ways to blame for these sessions. Does anybody have questions, rebuttals, arguments before we begin? So usually we'll read one at a time and talk about them, but I want to put a few poems into the air first I will ask you to call out phrases and words that are interesting to you after we hear it the second time, but we'll wait to have conversation about it so we've got three in the room, kind of a little critical mass of poetry first. Okay, so we're going to start with the first poem on the packet. It's by a writer named Alicia Suskind Ostreicher. I'm just going to, can I hand you these, and then if more people come in while we're reading?
Yeah.
People should have them at this point. Everybody has a packet at this point, right? Okay. Welcome. Come on in. So as I said, I'll read it the first time, and then I'll invite someone else to read it the second time. So this first one is by Alicia Suskind Ostreicher, and the title is The Blessing of the Old Woman, the Tulip, and the Dog. To be blessed, said the old woman, is to live and work so hard, God's love washes right through you, like milk through a cow. To be blessed, said the dark red tulip, is to knock their eyes out with the slug of lust implied by your upended skirt. To be blessed, said the dog, is to have a pinch of God inside you, and all the other dogs can smell it. Who wants to read that one? What brave soul will be first? Thank you, brave soul.
Evening Star?
No, sorry, the same poem again.
Oh, I'm waiting for Evening Star.
Okay, great, thank you.
To be blessed, said the old woman, is to live and work so hard God's love washes right through you like milk through a cow. To be blessed, said the dark red tulip, is to knock their eyes out with the slug of lust implied by your upended skirt. To be blessed, said the dog, is to have a pinch of God inside you and all the other dogs can smell it.
Thank you. So just call out, if you would, words or phrases or maybe even whole lines that struck you, resonated with you.
Slug. Slug of lust.
They're knocked their eyes out with a slug of lust. All those hard words.
Washes.
Right through you.
Pinch.
Can smell it.
Bless.
A pinch of God.
Old woman. All right, let's read the poem just to the right there at the top by Sappho. 7th century BCE poet, originally writing in Greek. So this poem is translated by Diane Rayer. Evening star who gathers everything, shining dawn scattered, you bring the sheep and the goats, you bring the child back to its mother. You wanted to read that one?
No.
Go for it.
No, I can't. Sorry. Child back to its mother.
Mm-hmm. I'll read it.
Thank you.
Evening star, who gathers everything, shining dawn scattered. You bring the sheep and the goats, you bring the child back to its mother.
Thank you. Phrases, lines, or words that are speaking to you from that one?
Gathers everything.
Scattered.
Shining dawn shattered. Rain.
The next little poem is by Izumi Shikibu, a 10th century Japanese poet, and this is translated by Jane Hirschfield and Mariko Aratani. Although I try to hold the single thought of Buddha's teaching in my heart. I cannot help but hear the many crickets' voices calling as well. Will someone read that for me?
Although I try to hold the single thought of Buddha's teaching in my heart, I cannot help but hear the many crickets' voices calling as well.
Thank you. Phrases, lines, words.
Although I try.
Crickets' voices. Try.
In my heart.
Single thought.
Single thought in my heart.
So now that we have three poems out in the room, what, if anything, in these poems is resonating with you? Do you identify with anything or anyone in these poems? What's speaking to you here and how?
Well, particularly in the first one and the third one, I hear, you know, some lightheartedness and humor. Mm-hmm. You know, they make you chuckle mm-hmm. because it's so true. And the thing about poetry is, you know, every word is critical. It's like no extra words, and they've
all got to do more than one kind of work.
I like the second one because that's my favorite time of night. That's just such a beautiful time of lightness in the world. So that one really speaks to me. Mm. When that first evening star comes up. Mm.
The third one for me, the idea of having an intention and a right thing, and then the reality that is different.
Mm-hmm. I like places where the sacred and the ordinary intersect, and I feel that, especially in the first and third, but that this kind of sacredness or blessedness, and then the, like milking a cow or a flower or a dog or the kind of common.
They're deeply mm-hmm. sensual.
Yeah.
They're really rooted in the body, in the physical life, in the senses.
I find they're calling on different times of day or life, or just very brief, like the moment, or something very long in time.
Yeah. I like the idea of being gathered, and I feel like that it's different words, but I feel like the sense of all three is sort of being gathered from the inside out, or sort of. Just, I love that.
Mm. Right. The tulips are, of course, gathered. Cows are gathered in the rain. Dogs gathered together.
I really resonate with the first one because it feels so tangible to me. I know what an old woman is, a dark red tulip and a dog. And so it feels more approachable, I think. Mm-hmm. And the language is simple in many ways, and then I kind of read it again and peel back a little bit more.
I also love how in that first poem that declares itself to be a blessing, it's body. You know, it's got the slug of lust, and we all know where dogs check for the smell of God, right? We know which end they go to. So there's a kind of a bodiness and an earthiness there. But depending on what you have been taught to associate with blessing might be startling. Does anybody have anything they're burning to say about any of these before we read another one?
Well, that body brings me forth. The mothering, the childbearing.
It's here.
Mm-hmm. In Buddha, you think of another way of the universal And then they're cyclical through each life. Each life marks part of the cycle. So for embodiment of blessing over time, through cycles and through our body, through the body that is born in that cycle.
Let's flip the page over and read the poem by Elizabeth Alexander. This is called Praise Song for the Day. And as I was gathering the poems for this packet, I was thinking about different kinds of blessing. And certainly I think a praise song is a kind of blessing. This is a very particular praise song, and it's a poem that I have started carrying with me and reading in different contexts, because it has a different meaning now, I think, than when it was first written. This was written for Barack Obama's first inauguration, and a very different moment. So as you hear it the two times, I would really invite you to think about how it might be a praise song for this day, for the day we find ourselves living in now. Okay. Praise song for the day. Each day we go about our business, walking past each other, catching each other's eyes or not, about to speak or speaking. All about us is noise. All about us is noise and bramble, thorn and din, each one of our ancestors on our tongues. Someone is stitching up a hem, darning a hole in a uniform, patching a tire, repairing the things in need of repair. Someone is trying to make music somewhere with a pair of wooden spoons on an oil drum, with cello, boombox, harmonica, voice. A woman and her son wait for the bus. A farmer considers the changing sky. A teacher says, take out your pencils, begin. We encounter each other in words, words spiny or smooth, whispered or declaimed, words to consider, reconsider. We cross dirt roads and highways that mark the will of someone and then others who said, I need to see what's on the other side. I know there's something better down the road. We need to find a place where we are safe. We walk into that which we cannot yet see. Say it plain, that many have died for this day. Sing the names of the dead who brought us here, who laid the train tracks, raised the bridges, picked the cotton and the lettuce, built brick by brick the glittering edifices they would then keep clean and work inside of. Praise song for struggle. Praise song for the day. Praise song for every hand-lettered sign, the figuring it out at kitchen tables. Some live by, love thy neighbor as thyself. Others by, first, do no harm. Or, take no more than you need. What if the mightiest word is love? Love beyond marital, filial, national. Love that casts a widening pool of light. Love with no need to preempt grievance. In today's sharp sparkle, this winter air, anything can be made. Any sentence begun, on the brink, on the brim, on the cusp, praise song for walking forward in that light. This song is such a song. It is a song. This poem is such a pleasure in the mouth. Who wants to read it out loud?
Each day we go about our business, walking past each other, catching each other's eyes or not, about to speak or speaking. All about us is noise. All about us is noise and bramble, thorn and din, each one of our ancestors on our tongues. Someone is stitching up a hem, darning a hole in a uniform, patching a tire, repairing the things in need of repair. Someone is trying to make music somewhere with a pair of wooden spoons on an oil drum with cello, boombox, harmonica, voice. A woman and her son wait for the bus. A farmer considers the changing sky. The teacher says, "Take out your pencils. Begin." We encounter each other in words. Words spiny or smooth, plain. Words to consider, reconsider. We cross dirt roads and highways that mark the will of someone and then others, who said, "I need to see what's on the other side. I know there's something better on the road. We need to find a place where we are safe. We walk through that which we cannot yet see. Say it plain, that many have died for this day. Sing the names of the dead brought us here, who laid the train tracks, raised the bridges, picked the cotton and the lettuce, built brick by brick the glittering edifices they would then keep clean, work inside it. Praise song for struggle, praise song for the day, praise song for every hand-lettered sign, figuring it out at kitchen tables. Some live by love, some live by love thy neighbor as thyself, others by first do no harm, or take no more than you need. What if the mightiest word is love? Love beyond marital, filial, national, love that casts a widening pool of light, love with no need to preempt grievance. In today's sharp sparkle, this winter air, anything can be made, any sentence begun. On the brink, on the brim, on the cusp, praise song for walking forward in that light."
Thanks. So if you call out lines, phrases, words that are speaking to you.
Many have died for this day.
Spiny.
Love that casts a widening pool of light. Each one of our ancestors on our tongues.
Bramble.
On the brink, on the brim, on the cup.
Noise.
I know there's something better down the road.
Declaimed.
I need to see what's on the other side.
What if the mightiest word is love?
Figuring it out at kitchen tables.
Pick the cotton and the lettuce.
For struggle.
We walk into that which we cannot yet see.
So how do you find yourself responding to this poem? Where do you connect with it or identify with it? Or where does it send your thoughts?
I see it as calling for love in all the everyday moments. In the stanza where it's just saying praise song for struggle, praise song for the day, praise song for every hand-lettered sign. That's the first time it brings in like the poem's title. And so all the buildup of these common moments then like brings you into struggling through those moments with love, because that's how it ends it. It's saying all this progress that is in front of us to make can be worked towards in everyday moments with love at the center.
I feel a little sour. I felt hopeful like this 8 years ago, and I don't feel hopeful like this. I mean, I want to feel hopeful, but we encounter each other in words, and the words politically that I'm encountering are hard.
A lot of spiny words.
It's not about love, and it's not about these things that I think we should be living by. It doesn't feel that way to me.
But I feel like it is. I feel like the
regardless of the leadership and regardless of the rhetoric that goes back and forth politically, that when it comes down to we the people and our relationships and our what direction we face, I feel actually that it's quite optimistic, and I feel that it could be a poem for any day from the day it was written forward. And maybe I'm just blocking the bunch of names out.
No, I like that. I think it's a different struggle. Like, I think of Crayson for walking forward in that light. Like, that was 8 years ago, that light was different. But that light, I mean, walking towards the light, walking with hope, walking in light is, I mean, as timeless as ageless is our call, I think.
And in some ways, we're doing that even stronger than we were 8 years ago, because we each want our voices to be heard in a way that we maybe think they're not being heard right now.
Well, and I think that difference, especially knowing the history of the poem, is why the phrase "that many have died this day" jumped out, because many have died for this day, whether we like this day or not. Like. Everybody who has died for the changes that came in the future have died for those changes, whether or not that's what they would have wanted or what we would like to have done for that. I mean, we tend to honor the dead and the things that they accomplished when we can focus on their accomplishments and not think about that they've still... Those sacrifices are there whether or not they're being fulfilled. Kind of, and there's something, it sounds very negative, but there's something very hopeful about that to me, that it's all of that history is still there. And it speaks to me that there wasn't a time when the sacrifices of others were fulfilled and end of story. Like, that today is not the end of a story any more than it was earlier or will be in the future. That every day contains all of the weight of the past, good and bad.
But it just makes me think of that, but we often celebrate the struggle after we're through it instead of while we're in it.
And then that passage makes me think of the people that laid the tracks were immigrants. Mm-hmm. The people who picked the cotton were slaves. The people who pick our lettuce are migrant workers, and we don't value their struggle.
Right.
Even though those that history have forgotten have built this nation, we value the politicians who raised them, not the everyday man and woman who created this.
Yeah, I see. I hear this as people and human race keep just marching forward. And under the most adverse of circumstances, they keep doing their daily lives in many ways. We do. And this speaks a lot about that. That no matter who's dictating us or governing us or positive or negative, you know, we still get up in the morning and seek food and shelter and hopefully love and good work. And I don't know, I think it just speaks to the tenacity of the human race.
I find it interesting that the value that we would like to embody, that loving thy neighbor as thyself and doing no harm and not taking more than you need. I find it interesting that in this poem, like it does, name all of these other lines. It's some live by this, and some have been making music, and some have been hemming their clothes, and some have been picking cotton. So I just find it interesting that the value that we would ideally embody is named in this poem to be that of some.
As opposed to everyone? Is that what you mean?
Right. So the question at the end is, the mightiest word is love, but how does it get embodied?
I have some thoughts about that, but what do others think of that? How do others respond to that question?
I mean, my first thought when looking at that is not so much thinking about people who are actually living those things, but just saying that. Like, some live by this, others by this, or this. I thought of it in a much more superficial way of like she's gonna pull it all into a central idea, whereas everybody else just sort of had, I think this is how we should be, and oh, I think this is how we should be. Like, to me, that's kind of how I was reading that sense of some, but you're right, that's kind of just like, it's interesting that no matter who you are or whatever you think, you assume that that thing is a universal thing. And you find a way to see it in everybody's way of talking. Like, you're like, oh yeah, it's just another way of saying the thing that I say. You know, and that's kind of what I was pulling out of it.
That's funny because I think of everything as almost everything that we invent as human beings as including some, but probably not all. Even if I wish it was included by, certain things were included by all, I know in reality everyone won't have the same axioms of philosophy and lifestyle.
Yeah, I most saw it as like starting from one end of the country and sort of flying over and stopping at one house and going over and stopping at another house, and so that each person's walk is still all in this one, like one community.
I think this is a great example of the way the particular can be. The particular and the sensory can be more powerful than the abstract and theoretical. That the poem, this would be a very different poem without the specificity of someone is stitching up a hem, darning a hole in a uniform, patching a tire. If instead of those lines, the poet had only said, all over, people are repairing the things in need of repair. Right? It would not have the same kind of weight, because what we need before she can get to that is those specific images. Mm-hmm. We need to see the stitching up of a hem. We all understand about hems and stitching, mm-hmm. right? We all know what a hole is. We know what a uniform is. And we picture that. We might all picture different uniforms. But images come to mind. We participate in the making of the poem because of those images. Patching a tire. So she goes from those specifics to that larger statement, repairing the things in need of repair, which I would argue that we probably intuitively understand means more than just those physical things of tires and uniforms with holes in them and hems, mm-hmm. right? That from those tactical specifics, we go to the larger idea, the poem gets a certain kind of lift mm-hmm. from moving from those tactical things, right?
But there is a class or socioeconomic component to it, because I mean, I can, whether I've waited for a bus or not, I can picture it, but there isn't. Do you know what I'm?
Oh yeah, I mean, this is not a poem of.
There is struggle within the rich, and there's struggle when you have a lot of money, but it's a different kind of struggle than hemming and busing and absolutely. Uniforms and that.
You're absolutely right. And that's why those things later in the poem about, say, the names of the dead who brought us here, who laid the train tracks, raised the bridges, picked the cotton and the lettuce, is not, say, the names of the dead who brought us here, who designed the bridges, mm-hmm. right? Who also had a valuable part to play,
right?
But what she's wanting to call out is the people who laid the bricks, yeah. who as you were pointing out, were often not treated as individuals, not even free, not even paid. And she's saying their place is here as well, that they are also celebrated today. Right. So I wanted to follow that first little group of poems with this one because I think there's a huge range that the poems span in terms of the scale on which they're operating, both in terms of how large or small they are, just in terms of numbers of words, but in terms of what they're trying to encompass. The time goes so quick. We could spend the rest of the time talking about this poem, but I want us to also look at some other poems. So does anybody have anything they're burning to say about that last poem before we move on? All right. Great conversation, guys. Thank you for being willing to jump in. Let's read, in the right-hand corner, you'll flip over another page, it's called Prayer to the Sockeye Salmon. It's on the same page as Go Gentle. It's just below that, Prayer to the Sockeye Salmon. Several of these poems, by the way, are from a beautiful anthology that Jane Hirschfield put together called Women in Praise of the Sacred. And this is from that. Fuck you, the woman's prayer. Prayer to the Sockeye Salmon. Welcome, O supernatural one, O swimmer, who returns every year in this world that we may live rightly, that we may be well. I offer you, swimmer, my heart's deep gratitude. I ask that you will come again, that next year we will meet in this life, that you will see that nothing evil should befall me. O supernatural one, O swimmer, now I will do to you what you came here for me to do. Will someone read that?
Welcome, O supernatural one, O swimmer, who returns every year in this world that we may live rightly, that we may be well. I offer you, swimmer, my heart's deep gratitude. I ask that you will come again, that next year we will meet in this life, that you will see that nothing evil should befall me. O supernatural one, O swimmer, now I will do to you what you came here for me to do.
Thank you. So calling out words, phrases that speak to you.
O swimmer.
That would be... I will do to you what you came here for me to do.
That next year we'll meet in this life.
Was anyone surprised or found themselves puzzled by that last line? Now I will do to you what you came here for me to do.
Puzzled that it's kind of shocking, but you kind of expect it to.
So what's shocking about it?
Well, partly because you know she's going to kill it and eat it. She's praying to it and asking for her own protection, but yet it seems that she's going to kill it then, but yet in their culture and their beliefs, you know, she says, come back again next year. So she's not really killing it. It's a spiritual being, not just the body of the fish. So maybe by killing and eating it, she releases it to go back and come again. I don't know.
Yeah, this idea that I'm going to do what you know I'm going to do, and you came here so I could do it to you, that I have never thought that while purchasing my salmon. That this is a new way of relating to that communion of the beings that I consume.
Well, and for me, it's sort of a it's a quick switch in the image that you have in your head of what's happening right now.
Yeah,
like you kind of have this much vaguer, prayerful, like, you know, ceremony kind of priestess, you know, talking of, you know, this bigger thing, and then the last line, at least for me, suddenly it's like, oh no, it is a specific woman, like, with a fish in front of her, doing a prayer for a very specific action in her life, that it's not a, you know, it feels so universal because it's like, oh, supernatural one, like, it feels like it's supposed to be about kind of everywhere, but it's taking all of that and saying, no, this is about this exact moment right here, and it's a prayer you say specifically right before you cut up a fish, like that. You know, we don't normally think of prayers in our life as that, especially since in most of the sort of Western Christian culture, you know, other than grace, you know, you don't have that same sort of like, I'm gonna have a prayer for this thing that I do every day, you know. So that to me was why, you know, why it's jarring, is that it's like the scene flips on the movie and it's a different woman in a different place.
It's one of the things I really value about poetry in general, but particularly about poems that are some form of prayer, is that my sense of what a good poem is that it has something in it that startles me, that surprises me, that is unexpected. Mm-hmm. And I feel that way when I'm writing a poem as well as I'm reading a poem. That if by the end of the poem there isn't something that has disturbed or startled or unsettled me, caused me to see things differently, then the poem hasn't gone far enough. It's one of the things that causes me to reread poems that I love again and again, that the layers of that continues to yield up something because of that sense of surprise.
This also made me think that the salmon, you know, they come back up the river. I saw this as happening in a river. And the salmon lay their eggs, and those salmon go back up to sea, and the next batch comes in the river the next year. Yeah. And she was honoring that.
Yeah.
And it also reminds me of all the fishermen I know in my life who truly honor the salmon. And people think, how can you go kill the salmon and eat it? You must be like, have this killer instinct. And I think it's so sweet when they say, no, we really honor and we feel blessed by the salmon, but we still eat them and kill them.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me, last September, I went hiking with my sister in the Goat Rocks Mountains, which has a lot of mountain goats, and right as she was becoming a vegan, and we met this guy who has one of the like five permits to hunt goat in Washington. And so we were kind of asking about it and, you know, how do you even do that? Because we had to backpack in here. He's like, well, you gotta kill it, then, you know, pack it in the snow to keep it fresh, and then like take it apart and pack out piece at a time. And he sort of explained this whole thing. And then he says, you know, it's a real labor of love. Which my sister just like could not compute. Like, what are you talking? Like, and she like hung on to that phrase forever. Now she tells everybody every time we talk about going to Goat Rocks. But yeah, I understood it right away when he was talking about that. It's like, I see this whole thing as much bigger than just I wanted to eat some goat, because you know, it's a lot easier ways to get goat meat than than personally backpacking them out 4 days. But.
Well, I was taken off guard about how vulnerable she was being to this thing she's about to kill. Mm-hmm. So as I was the first read, I was like, why is she's gonna eat this thing? Why is she talking to it like this? Mm-hmm. Why is she saying like, hi Neil, I want to live rightly and do well, and I'm getting to your dinner plate. Like, I see you next year. Like,
well, the other piece of it,
okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about things?
That salmon is going to get used by something, because that salmon, after it lays its eggs, or for, well, I don't know about the males, but the females, once they lay their eggs, they're going to die within days. So the salmon knew she was going to be gone soon.
I was the daughter of a salmon fisherman, and I remember the fish being just so brilliant. When you see them, they shine and sparkle like stars. There's so much light, and their meat is so bright, so red, and it's amazing to hold them in your hands. My father had a special knife and a board that he used every single time for his 30 years of fishing, every time he cut one for the family.
I can already hear your blessing starting to All right, let's flip over and let's read My Mother's Body by the poet Marie Howe. My mother's body. Bless my mother's body, the first song of her beating heart and her breathing. Her voice, which I could dimly hear, grew louder. From inside her body, I heard almost every word she said. Within that girl, I drove to the store and back, her feet pressing pedals of the blue car, her voice, first gate to the cold, sunny mornings, rain, moonlight, snowfall, dogs. Mm-hmm. Her kidneys failed. The womb where I once lived is gone. Her young, astonished body pushed me down that long corridor, and my body hurt her. I know that. 24 years old. I'm old enough to be that girl's mother, to smooth her hair, to look into her exultant, frightened eyes, her bed sheets stained with chocolate, her heart in constant failure. It's a girl, someone must have said. She must have kissed me with her mouth. First grief, first air. And soon I was drinking her. First food. I was eating my mother, slumped in her wheelchair, one of my brothers pushing it across the snowy lawn, her eyes fixed, her face averted. Bless this body she made, my long legs, her long arms and fingers, our voice in my throat speaking to you now. Can someone read it?
Bless my mother's body, the first song of her beating, heart and her breathing, her voice, which I could dimly hear, grew louder. From inside her body, I heard almost every word she said. Within that girl, I drove to the store and back, her feet pressing, pedals of the blue car, her voice, her first gate to the cold, snowy mornings, rain, moonlight, snowfall, dogs. Her kidneys failed. The womb where I once lived is gone. Her young, astonished body pushed me down that long corridor. And my body hurt her, I know that, 24 years old. I'm old enough to be that girl's mother, to soothe her hair, to look into her exultant, frightened eyes, her bedsheet stained with chocolate, her heart in constant failure. It's a girl, someone must have said. She must have kissed me. With her mouth, first grief, first air, and soon I was drinking her, first food. I was eating my mother. Slumped in her wheelchair, one of my brothers pushing it, across the snowy lawn, her eyes fixed, her face averted. Bless this body she made, my long legs, her long arms and fingers, our voice in my throat speaking to you now.
Thank you. Phrases, words that are resonant for you?
A voice.
Her young, astonished body.
Heart in constant failure.
kidney failure.
And soon I was drinking her first food. I was eating my mother.
My, her, ours. Our voice in my throat speaking to you now.
I heard her.
Do you find yourself identifying anyone or anything in this poem?
The phrase, I know that I'm 24 years old, I'm old enough, really resonated because that does feel like about the time when I started to get old enough to realize things.
My mother was a person, not just my mother.
Yeah, it's sort of, I feel like it's a prime time for you to start realizing all the false things that your child brain put together that then kind of went unquestioned just by chance. And so you start to realize, see things outside of the way they are explained to a child or understood by a child. Mm-hmm. Even though you had the capacity to know that earlier, if it doesn't come up, it doesn't change. Mm-hmm.
This morning in a session, we talked about so many of the stories, maybe this was just my group, but that in so many of the Bible stories, the women's voices are left out and mm-hmm. we're left to imagine what happened. Mm-hmm. And I see that in here. I think women are just really good at like imagining the things that happened. And so here she is imagining what her mother must have done mm-hmm. and kind of writing that story mm-hmm. for her. And also just the notion of like, the kiss was first grief. And I was trying to figure out if that grief was the child's grief or the mother's grief. Mm. And I, having played both of those roles myself, I think when I kissed my child for the first time, there was also the reality that this was a person who would die one day. I remember feeling that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's exactly what that moment's about, but that really struck me.
And first separation.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And for the child, right, having lived in this womb of safe water and sort of be out now in the world.
My mother has been on dialysis for 15 years, and mm-hmm. I go to visit her, and she's going into her treatment while I go to work. And she keeps telling me how many births she had and how many abortions she had, and how that really... because I haven't had any babies, that I will be much easier to match when it's time to get a kidney. So I hurt her by being this foreign body.
Mm. Interesting.
Wow. Mm.
I feel like I came to that age where I'm like, okay, my parents are flawed human beings. And then, but every time I visit them, they're in a different state. I revert back, and how I'm like, oh, mother, but then I'm like, I don't want to miss the chance of having a relationship, like an adult relationship with my parents. I don't want to have to be wheeling them in a wheelchair and maybe having their mind not there anymore. Like knowing my parents did a lot for me, and I still have the child voice in my head, and I can't use like the adult voice that says thank you.
I'm struck with sort of the interweaving, and I love how she balances from sort of the mom's voice to her voice to child voice to aging. as I get older and my hips start to hurt, right where my mom's hips hurt, and she's 84, and you know, you just start to see how woven into each other you are. I think that's what I'm struck by.
One last poem, just to send you out into the rest of the day. If you come to the sessions tomorrow, please bring this with you. I'll have a few more copies, but obviously if you can bring this with you, that'd be great. Thank you so much for for the conversation today. You know, one of the great gifts for me in taking poems into groups of people is that I always come back with an enlarged sense of the poems as you speak back to me what you see in the poems, so thank you for your generosity in that, each of you. Are there any questions about what we're going to do tomorrow? Let me just say that if you talk to somebody who didn't come to either of these sessions today and was kind of interested in coming to tomorrow but isn't sure whether it's okay that they weren't here today, it's totally okay that they weren't here today, and they're welcome tomorrow. So this is by a poet named Lucille Clifton, who, like Marie Howe, has been a huge influence on me as a writer. So this is called Blessing the Boats. Also just seemed appropriate, given that we all come and go. Blessing the Boats. It's on the same page as Let It Feel. And I hope, by the way, that I always try to give a packet of poems that's larger than we have time to do in the workshop so that you can go away with some more poems to read on your own as well. Blessing the Boats at St. Mary's. May the tide that is entering even now the lip of our understanding carry you out beyond the face of fear. May you kiss the wind, then turn from it, certain that it will love your back. May you open your eyes to water, water waving everywhere, water waving forever. And may you, in your innocence, sail through this to that. Will someone read that aloud for us one more time? Please.
May the tide that is entering even now the lip of our understanding carry you out beyond the face of fear. May you kiss the wind, then turn from it, certain that it will love your back. May you open your eyes to water, water waving forever, and may you, in your innocence, sail through this to that.
Thank you all for being here. I hope to see you in the sessions tomorrow.